WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm your host, Jason Mann, and again, returning to the program after a wonderful appearance for the first time talking about King of Trios, it is Casey of the Hammerlock Dialectic. Casey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back there, Jason.
No problem. I am glad to have you on, and we're going to talk about a film about wrestling that, as far as I can tell, no one has ever written about or discussed at any length ever.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
We are breaking new ground here. And it's a film that's reasonably widely available. If you have Netflix, you can find it easily. And definitely a movie I think we both encourage people to check out, because it's really a very interesting film. Very good in some ways, not so good in other ways, but definitely an interesting movie. It's called Below the Belt. It is from the year 1980, and it is about women's wrestling, and it stars Regina Baff, who is a actress who apparently was notable enough on Broadway to have been nominated for a Tony. And she plays the Mexican Spitfire Rosa, who breaks into the wrestling business and has adventures, and wonderful and horrible and interesting things happen.
Definitely, yeah. I there's one thing I was finding on the internet, which I'm not sure if it's entirely true, but I think the film was actually filmed in 1974, but wasn't released until 1980.
Yeah, I saw that, and I mean, it's certainly possible that... I guess that could be possible, although the wrestling footage, I'm pretty sure at least some of it is after 74. In particular, something at the beginning that we'll talk about that I'm pretty sure would be at least like 77 or so. But
okay.
She would have been 30 at the time, roughly, if they'd filmed it, you know, a year or so before it came out. She would have been 30 at that time, and she looks younger than that. So it's hard to say. There's so little to know about the filming and what we read in the description. Some of it tends to be wrong anyway. But if anyone listening to this knows about the film, knows something detailed that's written about the film, and wants to send it our way, that would be wonderful, because I would be very curious to know more about it. But. So, before we get into the movie, any just general thoughts about it, or anything you want to discuss before we get into it?
We're going to talk about this a lot, but it's actually, you know, when you think about a women's wrestling movie made in that particular era, I didn't expect it to be as, I don't want to say artsy almost, but, you know, it's not scandalous or anything. It's actually just kind of a really decent drama, you know, and I was really, really surprised by that, because I found the movie totally by accident. A friend of mine was asking about Netflix, and she's a big MMA fan. Lobster is like the coolest person ever, and she was wondering if there was any Bellator on Netflix. So I looked up Bellator on Netflix, and they had like a Tinkerbell movie and some other things, and then like on that same page was like a movie called Below the Belt, which I had never heard of. So I ended up clicking on that and ended up watching it. So it was something I found totally by accident, and it was really surprising about how good it was. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd had it on just sort of on my queue. Like I searched for wrestling, and it, you know, was one of the things that came up after all the WWE stuff. And I'm like, oh, I never heard of this, and just clicked on it. And until you mentioned how exciting it was, I hadn't really given much thought, that it was interesting. Maybe you weren't quite that enthusiastic about it, but you certainly liked it. And after I saw it, I'm like, yeah, let's do a podcast on it for sure. Definitely a film worthy of discussion and seeing. So hopefully we can spur some of that, once, people, you know, get a chance to listen to this and get a chance to check it out. So we start off with some wrestling footage. I'm pretty sure it's Madison Square Garden. It's definitely Bruno Sammartino, and I'm pretty sure the other wrestler he's facing, who is in a purple mask and purple pants, is Killer Kowalski. Because I know that Kowalski worked around 76, 77, maybe even into 78, as a masked wrestler tagging with wrestler later became Big John Studd. And they were, the Executioners. And they were tag champions. So I'm pretty sure based on the body and based on what you can see of the face under the mask, that is Killer Kowalski. So we're set in the arena, and there's, of course, loud, rambunctious cheers, and they show the action in the ring. And then we cut to a, concession stand, girl working behind the counter who is Rosa, our protagonist. And there's an old dude with a cigarette and a sailor hat, talks about Tommy Duke's packing them in, and he sort of name drops all of, like, kind of the badass old women's wrestlers, including Mae Young is among those who are name dropped, and he's kind of going on about how great wrestling was and so on and so forth. Then there's a concessions dude in a gaudy red striped jacket and kind of a popcorn hat, for lack of a better, like a diner hat, who's very much channeling 1979 John Travolta, and he sort of hits on her. And we sort of established that Rose is a little bit meek, maybe a little sheepish, working in sort of this dead end job, but in this, I guess this exciting atmosphere of the professional wrestling, and, kind of, that's sort of our first scene sort of just sort of sets the table for what's happening next.
Yeah. And at that point, she kind of just accosts him almost, in terms of rejecting his advances, and spills all of his sodas and
right
and everything like that, which was a little bit humorous, but yeah,
right after that we get to the where she's waiting to use a payphone, and there's a man in a bow tie, kind of a smallish man, kind of cheap looking, I guess a bit. And she's being impatient, wanting to use the phone. And then our concessions guy gets fresh with her, and then she sort of kneels him in the balls and knocks him down. He spills all his drinks. He's clearly embarrassed. He sort of runs away. And then our bow tie dude introduces himself, Bobby Fox. He's a wrestling promoter, and he calls her a natural born wrestler. Tells Rosa to go to Millie Burke, who runs a gym for women wrestlers, and then sort of comes up with some rambling ideas for what she should be called. None of them particularly very good, but he's sort of meant to be kind of a comedic character for the most part. Although I don't know, we'll kind of have to go into it as we develop with him. I don't know if we're to believe that he might be a little bit of a creepo as well, or if I'm just sort of reading into that based on what I know about men who run women's wrestling promotions.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. Like I wasn't sure. I mean, he's definitely a little bit comedic. I personally got a little bit more of, not necessarily a father figure kind of vibe from him, but everyone seemed to be kind of, admired him for somehow intervening in their lives in a positive way. And it kind of comes up a few times throughout the movie that, he kind of plucked these different characters, and made them into wrestlers. And this was seen as a very positive development for most of these people. So I'm not really sure how to read that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I figure he's a little schmaltzy. He's a little bit, maybe even a little touchy-feely at times, although no one seems to particularly mind. So they certainly don't go so far as to make him like sinister particularly, but he's definitely, maybe it's just sort of that, like that old school, like that Richard Dawson vibe where, on Family Feud, Richard Dawson would always kiss. And that's just kind of how men could get away with that then. And it wasn't really like a weird thing then. And now it's a weird thing.
Yeah. I could definitely see that.
So we show the titles here there, and we have Terrible Tommy, the great star female wrestler who she they show her ring entrance, emphasize that she's the one that they're here to see, which of course is not really what would be realistic in wrestling in 1980 or 1974 or whenever, you know, where this story is to take place. Although, I guess we didn't mention at the beginning that this is based on a novel called Two Smithereens. A woman named Rosalind Drexler wrote the story, and it's based on her experiences getting into wrestling in 1951. So, you know, this is obviously kind of hearkening – the origin story at least is kind of hearkening back to an idea of what wrestling was, you know, at that point.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm actually kind of interested to track down this novel now, you know. It's good enough to make a movie after, you know. So
yeah, I guess it was well regarded. And you mentioned that she has a connection to Andy Warhol.
Yeah. Like one of the things I found is that Andy Warhol made a series of like silk screen printings or paintings, I guess, based on Polaroids he had of her dressed up as a wrestler. And I wasn't sure if it was her dressed up as, you know, the Mexican Spitfire, or if it was just her as like a generic wrestler. But I'm actually kind of curious to see if I can track those down now.
Yeah. Yeah. She is, and of course, Andy Warhol has, I don't know if he was a fan of wrestling, but he, was at the, I think it was the Iron Sheik's first title, or I'm sorry, Hogan's title win against the Iron Sheik, or maybe it was the War to Settle the Score, but he's on one of those specials and they interview him after, you know, one of those things about how exciting it is and so on and so forth. And it seems like he's kind of a guy who regularly shows up to the wrestling.
Yeah. Well, like I think I've seen the thing you're referring to, and he definitely seems like not excited necessarily because it's Andy Warhol, but kind of hip to what's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, we have the title sequence. This is the first of many songs during the movie that are played, and we don't hear what's going on. The music that's happening is the song, and it's a very the soundtrack has a very sort of a gospel-y vibe.
Yeah, like I was really surprised by how much music there was, and it's all kind of a little bit gospel-y. Like it feels like it's trying to tell a story, but I never really felt like the music ever, at least the lyrics of the music, ever really connected to what was going on so much. But it almost feels like literally half of the movie is music and montages.
A lot of the music and the montages, and I maybe if they'd have cut half of those out, I think it would have been more effective. I feel like they overdid it, but there is actually a couple of times where the music actually is like almost like on the nose. Like there's we'll kind of get into it later, but like when they're going in like Birmingham, there's the song's about going to Birmingham. It's like all these like southern like stereotypical things in the lyrics, you know. There's another one where she's like looking at glass and she's drawing like a rose in the glass right after she gets over a breakup, and the lyric in the song is actually talking about looking through glass. So I kind of felt like, you know, it was like one of those music videos where they almost take like the song too literally, you know.
I could definitely see this being like a Meatloaf music video almost. Yeah,
exactly. It just, yeah, it was sort of a weird balance. You know, I mean, I think it was like original, at least some of the music was original music made for the film, because they really get into like what's going on in the film a couple of times. But anyway, it's sort of a strange thing. Some of it does work pretty well, and some of it is just a little too much. But it's one of the few, you know, complaints I have about the movie. Other than that, this, I'm pretty much everything, at least get everything they were trying to do. So. And during that, we also have a montage sort of showing scenes of the city, you know, kind of your average, like showing the subway, showing people walking, showing the darkness and the bleakness and so on and so forth. And then next we get to, we go into a disc jockey booth, and the guy looks a little bit like Scott Glenn, or maybe even a little bit, Oh, I'm blanking on the actor now. I guess Scott Glenn is when where he. Oh, James Woods. A little bit like James Woods, more like John Glenn, but, or excuse me, Scott Glenn, not John Glenn. And he is a radio DJ. There are guys on the phone who wants to talk about UFOs, and I swear that this guy sounds a lot like Bill Apter doing a funny voice.
Yeah, like I could definitely hear that, and I listened to a lot of really bad AM radio, and this whole sequence had like a very like strict coast to coast AM vibe. If you ever stay up really late and listen to bad AM radio, where random crazy people just call in about Bigfoot and UFOs, and it's like during this whole conversation, the caller calls UFOs something else. He said like they were uniformly friendly objects or something like that. I forget.
It's basically the idea is that, he's stuck kind of in this loser job and all these people are calling. He doesn't care about any of them. Rosa shows up and they sort of trade whispers as he's on the air covering up the mic. Then sort of a caller notices her voice and mentioning Lady Wrestling, and they kind of go over the virtues of what they call Lady Wrestling. The closing line of women wrestling really makes me feel good. Their bodies against each other was a was a comical line.
Yeah, like this movie actually has a few lines that I think are kind of memorable almost, and I really hope for this movie to come like a for this movie to become a huge hit after this fabulous podcast, so we can actually say these lines and people will get it.
It's quotable, and the dialogue is, it's maybe not poetic, but it is more interesting dialogue than you. It's not just like standard pat, like somebody is just writing a movie, just without any inspiration. This is an attempt to make a good movie, I think.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I mean, I don't want to go into it a little bit too much, but there's quite a few little lines of dialogue that I think are actually kind of poignant almost.
Sure. So Rosa decides to show up to the gym. She's wearing her white fuzzy hat that she wears occasionally in the thing. Another sort of montage. You see her being sheepish. We see but don't hear her conversation with Mildred Burke, who is not identified yet, but but it's Mildred Burke, and I guess they. I'm not sure if they really identify her specifically. I mean, obviously, he says to go to Mildred Burke, and this is the woman that who it is. But I don't think they actually identify her as Mildred, and she doesn't really have. I mean, she may have like one or two lines, but she really doesn't have much dialogue. A lot of what they show is just her, being in the background and teaching.
Yeah, like it's kind of weird that they don't, make a big deal out of it, where, it's just very, here she is, she's Trainer, and it could have been anyone else. And
Right, yeah, it just happened to be Mildred Burke, but and she wasn't a name that I think would have been well known. I mean, she I think she was a reasonably well-known wrestler, like in the 40s and the 50s. But by this point, obviously, it's 25 years after her prime, and she would not necessarily have been known particularly well. I'm not even sure if she would have been known that well in the world of wrestling, because she'd kind of been on the periphery of it for so long. I mean, she was known as kind of a past women's champion, but I keep meaning to read the great book that was written about her life a few years ago, but I have not had a chance to do that yet. So we have We are introduced to the beautiful Boomerang, who is blowing bubble gum. Sort of immediately intimidates Rosa. They get into the ring. They sort of do some collar and elbow work. Rosa shows a bit of fire by actually getting her down a few times, and then we get to the point where they kind of give her a an attaboy, and then she asks, "Is that all there is to it?" And then Mildred Burke responds, "All you gotta do now is learn how to wrestle." So that was kind of a comedic line. And then Rosa meets her dad in a shop. I guess he either owns the shop, he's working there, and sort of negotiating with customers. Not exactly clear, what they're buying and selling or whatever, but it's not really that important. So they go to eat, and he tells her, or she tells him, that he wants to go to classes. They're sort of in this, like, I don't know, this little, you know, pizza shop or hot dog shop or whatever. It's just sort of a scuzzy little, you know, corner place. And it's interesting because I don't think there's actually a moment in the scene where they're looking at each other.
Yeah, like, I think it actually, this scene really establishes, you know, Rosa, you know, pre-wrestling as a character. You know, she's had, like, a string of, you know, failed relationships, and, you know, she mentions going back to school, and her father just seems really skeptical about her actually sticking to anything and actually, you know, doing anything with her life. And it's a little, you know, it actually really kind of defines who this character was at this point, I think.
Yeah, he's not mean to her or anything, but he doesn't look at her, and he seems like, you know, resigned that, you know, okay, this is going to be another thing you do that's going to fail, or you're going to quit when it gets hard, or you know, so on and so forth. So eventually she tells him that she's going to be a wrestler, which she found that's not for a girl. They kind of get into, you know, the idea of it being fake, and then, you know, she says, well, no, it's like magic. So they're clear, you know, at this point throughout the movie that wrestling, at least typically, is not as a show. It's not real. You know, they get into kind of the idea, you know, that obviously it's cooperation, and they even, you know, I would say expose the business in certain ways, going on and forth. But it's interesting that, you know, we're still in what is technically the, you know, the kayfabe era or whatever, where wrestling in most respects is still pretending to, you know, to be genuine. But obviously this, you know, movies like this and in a lot of circles, no one's buying it, you know?
Yeah. Well, this movie actually kind of, you know, very much, you know, very well defines, you know, that it's dealing in the real world. It's not, you know, dealing in this hyper, you know, real, you know, hyper world where wrestling is real, but everything, you know, wrestling is actually real. And there's a few scenes that actually kind of really play up to that I really, really enjoyed. And the final confrontation of the movie kind of puts that on its head a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, we see scenes of training with both men and women. Again, more music. You can see that she's kind of getting tougher at it and improving. Then, and she's jogging, and, you know, you kind of get some of the, you know, you get some of the typical Rocky type training stuff, you know. Obviously, it's a couple years after Rocky was popular, so everyone's kind of doing that a little bit. Then Boomerang's kind of warming up to her, invites her to go to the to the rodeo, then there's another scene with Rosa kind of learning, you know, kind of how to work a headlock. They kind of fiddle with each other a little bit and kind of play around. And Mildred, one scene of dialogue she has where she kind of gets mad at them, sort of putzing around a bit. Then we get a glance of them. You know, they're walking home. They're in a subway. And they've clearly been drinking a bit and are just kind of being, you know, a little bit silly. And then Boomerang asks, "You want to be friends?" And Rosa, not really getting what Boomerang is getting at, she's like, "I thought we already were." And then she kind of walks off, and you see this look, you know, this wistful look in Boomerang's eye that she wants to be more than just friends with Rosa.
Yeah, well, like, you know, for a movie this old, it kind of deals with this, you know, with, you know, Boomerang sexuality, you know, in a very tasteful way, I thought. Like, it was never mean-spirited or exploitive or anything like that.
Yeah, I, you know, for a movie, you know, of its time, it really is pretty, you know, mature presentation of that. And that's nice to see. You know, I think that she's, well, next scene when we see this up to a head fairly quickly. So, see Rosa come home, and she's getting physical with her boyfriend Glance, and they, you know, and she, you know, it's like she's really rough with him, and you can kind of see, and she even, you know, out and out says, like, you know, I really feel powerful when I do this. And it's giving her, you know, some power and some esteem and some strength. And she's kind of learning to almost control it for her sense. And actually, this is the part in which she says it's not fake, it's magic. Kind of describing the thrill of that to him, who is very skeptical. So we have another training montage.
More music.
Yeah, more music. Glantz and his very 1970s shirt do not seem to be super impressed by all of this. And we show them doing back bumps, and then Boomerang and Rose are sharing a bottle in the locker room, and you can just see in her face and in her body language that, you know, her desire for Rosa is rampant. And they talk about kind of going, you know, of going back to the rodeo, which she had been invited, and talking about cowboys being crude. They don't know the needs of a woman. Boomerang then says that she loves her and try to embrace her. She says, "Let me love you, Rosa. You don't got to do anything." And Rosa is basically kindly just really, you know, doesn't reciprocate at all. And that's kind of the end. And then Boomerang says, "I got a lot of questions," sort of, you know, I guess I'm not sure it really embraces her sexuality as much as it doesn't demonize it.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a little... So Boomerang's character is a really sad. I won't say sad, and, you know, that we should pity her, but, you know, she seems really lonely, and it doesn't, you know, diminish her sexuality, but it almost patronizes it a bit. I think where it almost kind of comes off as a childish crush she has on Rosa, where it's not like, you know, a full mature actualized person's, you know, feelings of, you know, love towards Rosa. It feels a little bit more childish almost, but it's still, yeah, it's kind of a sweet moment, and it's, you know, still fairly progressive, I think, you know, because a lot of movies, you know, even modern movies, you know, don't always treat, you know, sexuality with this sort of, you know, at least kindness.
Yeah, I mean, we're meant to sympathize her, we're meant to empathize with her and to see her, we meant to see her as a person, not as like somebody who's, you know, weird or terrible or wrong or, you know, maybe a little bit, maybe confused, you know, maybe, but, you know, we're, it's not presenting her in a hateful way, which, you know, is better than it being, than her being presented in a hateful way, which would be in a lot of movies, maybe even during this time, certainly in, you know, in decades, you know, leading up to this.
Yeah, definitely. It was never hateful, and it wasn't like very scandalous. And like, you know, searching for this film online, you know, some of like the DVD covers I've found of this film made the film out to be extremely scandalous, you know, and it never is. You know, it's always very tasteful, and you know, some characters are sexual and they're kind of seen in a sexual way, but for the most part, it's, you know, it's just a sweet movie, and, you know, it's never demeaning or scandalous, I don't think.
Not exploitative, you know.
Yeah.
It's just telling the story in a fairly natural way. So next, Rosa comes home, wakes up her boyfriend, who's not supposed to be there because he's supposed to be at work. He informs her that he got fired, and he's going to L.A., and this is their breakup scene, punctuated by the line, "We tried, baby." And then we get into another song, which is called Rosa. This one is the back. This is what I mentioned before, where, you know, she's looking out the window and it describes, you know, looking at out a window. So she draws a flower in the window. And this is the point we cut to. I forget if it's just, you know, like a montage again where we're showing some of the wrestling. But one of the wrestlers is Lenny Montana, who plays Luca Brasi in The Godfather.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Yeah,
And he has a couple of lines. He's not like a major part of the movie, but yeah, you know, he's obviously even though a small part of The Godfather, very memorable part of The Godfather.
Yeah, Blow the Bell is a star-studded cast here.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, Lenny Montana apparently was a fairly he was a wrestler and had a decent length wrestling career. I'm not familiar with his wrestling career at all, but he, you know, was, you know, wrestling got him into, movies, and given his, you know, given his size and so on and so forth, he, You know, it sort of makes sense that he would have been involved in professional wrestling. Apparently, he was NWA Central States Heavyweight Champion.
It's more than I can say for myself, you know. That's pretty good.
He was, and he held the Texas Tag Team Championship with Gene Kaninsky. So there you go.
Yeah.
So I guess he spent most of his career kind of in the Texas and the Mid-South. Wikipedia has a pretty extensive look at his life and career. Also, apparently, he worked for the Colombo Organized Crime Family in the 1960s.
Yeah, not a whole lot of work, you know, for a professional wrestler back then, I guess. So,
Doing time in Rikers Island, so good times. So,
yeah.
so we then we have more in-ring montage with another sort of, this is more of a jazzy type song. Rose is looking good. Slow motion with her dragging Boomerang around the ring, and this is actually during a tryout to see, you know, if they're going to be able to make the larger circuit. And the next scene, Boomerang is crying because she didn't make it. Rosa did. And then she decides she's going to go to Montana with a cowboy. And Rosa tries to wipe her face, wipe the tears from her face. And Boomerang keeps her from doing it and says that she's fine, that she'll be okay, and so on and so forth. And I wonder if we're supposed to read this as Rosa, almost coming on to her, like just sort of like, you know, I'll make you feel better, you know, because of this disappointment. I'll agree to, you know, to be sexual with you, even though it's not really my thing.
I wasn't sure. I didn't really see that so much, but I mean, Rosa's character at this point was kind of a floor mat where I think she was just really eager to kind of make the people around her happy or at least complacent because she didn't know how to deal with emotions that, I think she, I didn't necessarily see that, but I could definitely see her being willing to do a lot more than she might otherwise be willing to do just to, make Boomerang
Yeah,
happy.
and it may have just been a thing where, you know, where she's just is just being gentle and being friendly or so. But I just thought the fact that Boomerang like kept her from doing it and kind of kept that separation made me think that that might have been what they were trying to communicate. But it could be read either way, I'm sure. So now Rosa and her furry white hat again are on a bus. I should mention that Rosa, I probably should mention this at the top of the program, but Rosa, it looks maybe slightly like Gilda Radner. You know, that's kind of maybe the best, you know, as far as the hair and the size and the face, kind of that kind of looks a little bit like her. She's not particularly muscular. She's a little bit thicker than Gilda Radner, a little bit more athletic, but kind of has maybe curlier hair, but kind of has a. That sort of that 70s type look.
Yeah, she's definitely very mousy almost, where, her hair is kind of big and thick, but it kind of just, accentuates how small she is.
Montage lasts for a decent amount of time. We show her reading a wrestling magazine and then sort of at the end looking quite weary from the travel. Eventually she goes to the hotel. She meets Mr. Fox. Again, who at first is a little, or maybe doesn't seem confused, but it doesn't remember her name right away anyway. And then we're across the way in the booth where they're eating is Jeannie, who's sort of the old time legend, who I think is kind of maybe like the Mildred Burke or maybe even like the Fabulous Moolah type role, where she's sort of the older one. Who is sort of works with the young ones, although in this case it isn't quite like because Moolah also was like the top wrestler, and this and Jeannie's more the one who's kind of past her prime but has kept around sort of a handler like
Yeah, like Jeannie Burley, I think her name was, is she's kind of like, kind of like the liaison between, Bob Fox and the ladies who wrestle, and she it's weird because, like, people, at least the women in this movie, all look, they're all very iconic different types, and she, they keep on talking about how she's beyond her prime, but I thought she was actually probably the most attractive of the women that we actually see in the movie because she didn't really look all that old to me. which seems a little peculiar.
She wears very like colorful, like almost like Tammy Faye Baker type makeup in a couple of scenes. And it's not when she's wrestling, it's more when she's just sort of out. So that was kind of a little odd, you know? But, you know, yeah, she was a, you know, pretty older woman, but not like, not someone who you would think would not be able to make it in wrestling, particularly during this time in which, you know, the idea of the physical type who should be a woman wrestler is completely different from what we expect today with WWE divas.
Yeah, definitely. And she even makes mention that she didn't say she was a contender, but, you know, she said something to the effect that, you know, she, you know, basically had title shots but had never actually won, I think, was the impression we were supposed to get, that, you know, she was kind of always a, you know, a second place kind of, you know, wrestler.
Right, yeah, she was more of, you know, she wasn't really ever the champion, but she was just, you know, kind of the people's champion, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. And this scene actually has one of my favorite bits of dialogue in the entire film, where Jeannie, you know, talks to Rosa and she asks her, you know, want to do your nails? And Rosa's response is, I'm allergic. And then Jeannie's reply is, I've got plenty, take it. Which just was like the most bizarre bit of dialogue I've heard in a movie in a while, where it's, I mean, it was weird, I thought.
Like a Manchurian candidate type line where you're not really even clear what they're going, but you're so fascinated by what's going on that you kind of look past.
Yeah, like, I mean, I've never wore nail polish, so I'm not sure if women are allergic to it, but, you know, so I wasn't sure if that was, like, you know, something that doesn't even happen, and if it does, like, why would you then give the woman nail polish anyhow? You know, it was really nonsensical and kind of funny to me, I thought.
The idea is not paying attention to each other or
yeah.
Just kind of talking past each other, but then, I think Gene's line also of I take care of the girls and Bobby takes care of me is sort of that seems like an interesting arrangement, you know, and that is one of the reasons, like the thing I think about is the Bobby character a little bit of a creeper in that, like, you know, does he take advantage of them a little bit? I don't know. I don't know if I have anything behind having that idea. It's just, again, knowing kind of where these types, how or maybe in real life wrestling, I'm kind of throwing that on there. But anyway, we go to a bar and we kind of meet some of the other wrestlers who are part of the troupe. They're kind of in a bar swapping stories, and the two that are focused on the most are Vernie Vavoom and Leroy, John Leroy. And John Leroy is sort of like, he's probably, I don't know, maybe in his 50s, and definitely, you know, he's got a big belly, and he's sort of, he's gruff and copper and so on and so forth. And then he is with Vernie Vavoom, who is now, I think later they say she's 37, and she's been in the business since she was like 15. She lied about being 18, and just kind of how, you know, how Vernie was drawn in, and, you know, she was like stuck in this, you know, dead end town, and then, you know, they came in one day and they took her out of there and, you know, brought her into this adventure, and she's very, you know, and at this point they're very happy and they're very jolly, and they, you know, you think, oh, they're really, really enjoying what they do. And obviously, and as we get through the film, we find that, and they're not that there's definitely burnout, you know, not feeling, not good about this.
Yeah, like, it's actually kind of weird, because at this point we're like 35 minutes into the movie, maybe a bit more, and I actually think the main narrative arc, like, is actually between these two characters and their story. Like, their story, you know, was almost more interesting than the story of Rosa.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a subplot, but it dominates the, you know, the middle of the movie, and it's more, one of the more fascinating thing about the end. You know, it's probably the best act as well. It's a little bit like, this is a movie where it's a pretty subtle movie for the most part. Like, there's not a lot of like stuff that they throw in your face. It's more of a show movie than it is a tell movie. But even though I think this stuff is a more tell. I think just the way that it's played by the actors, Dolph Sweet is the he played Roy. He's actually is the main actor in Give Me a Break. That's a TV series. He played the old gruff, the police man, dad. And then the woman is Sierra. I don't know how to pronounce the last name, but like Petcher, who the most the thing that I the only thing that I recognize from her is she played a Vulcan who ends up being a Romulan in Star Trek.
It's a classic episode, yeah.
Data's Day, I believe, is that one is. So, so anyway, we get to the point where we're in the arena at a show. We have some little people wrestlers, loud fans, many of whom seem toothless and have tattoos. And there's another guy talking to Fox about Rosa, saying he's heard a lot about her and, you know, wonders when they're going to bring her out. Then backstage, the Leroy, he's very, very drunk. I'm not sure who exactly it's supposed to be, if it's supposed to be like the local promoter. But anyway, someone in authority who is not Fox demands blood, and the wrestlers say, well, we want $15 more each if we're going to do color. So,
the line is blood is extra, and he just says it in a really, like, the delivery of that line I actually really enjoyed, where it's just really kind of somber and just, you know, kind of poignant and meaningful, I thought.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's showing that weariness and showing that thing, you know. Then we go to the women who are sort of all getting ready in the locker room, and they all, you know, the couple of them are reading sort of letters and kind of talking about some of the fans who are, you know, creepy and so on and so forth. And then we cut back to Leroy, who's in the shower with his clothes on, sobering up, or at least attempting to, with the water draining on him. And then we get our first glance the actor, the character's name, Luke.
Luke, yeah.
Who is the actor who plays Brown in the Major League films, who I marked out when I saw him, because I was a big fan of those movies the first movie when I was a kid, and him being probably my favorite character in that movie, it was enjoyable to see him as where James Gammon is the actor who is in it.
Yeah, like, and at this point it introduces Luke and Tio, and I guess they're a tag team at this point, and those two characters kind of provide a really interesting dichotomy, I thought.
Yeah, there's just sort of matter of fact talking and getting ready, and then suddenly Luke is in this sort of like Viking or Genghis Khan type costume. I don't Tio's looked like particularly, but his was also, you know, colorful or ornate. It's just kind of the juxtaposition of these guys acting normal but having these elaborate costumes is amusing.
Yeah, like Tio was almost like a jaguar warrior or something like that, and Luke was playing, you know, I think his character is actually, his name was actually like the Viking, and he had like, you know, a chainmail helmet and you know, armor and fur and everything.
Exactly. Yeah. So then we cut to more acts in the ring, and we mentioned the San Martino and an executioner thing, and kind of some arena footage interspersed throughout. But clearly, you know, the arena footage was shot, you know, very much separately. I mean, there is arena footage of the performers, at least a little bit, particularly toward the end. But most of that is like wrestlers who are not in any other part of the movie.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird because, like, you know, that there are certain shots in the film where it does the Rocky thing, like Rocky One at least, where, you know, the entire audience is like clouded in black, so you really can't see them. But there's some other shots in the film where there's actual wrestling going on, or, you know, stuff going on, you know, and the walkway to the ring itself, where it's a packed arena. So it's kind of interesting to see that.
Yeah. And we do see, there's a lot of wrestlers I don't recognize, but we do see, the Valiants and Lou Albano.
Yeah. I definitely saw Lou Albano, which was actually really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, most of the other wrestlers I didn't really recognize. My guess is that I mean, obviously if you have the wrestlers that they had, that they were in Madison Square Garden, or at least in an arena that did that, had WWF shows. My guess is maybe some Florida too. They definitely had exteriors in Florida, and a lot of the film takes place in Florida, and it would kind of make sense that, because a lot of the talent that wrestled in WWF also wrestled in Florida. Those two promotions, were close. So actually, maybe even some of that may have just been in Florida. I didn't really recognize it as Madison Square Garden in the beginning. I mean, it could have been, but I'm not clear on whether it was for sure. I don't know MSG well enough, particularly the 1970 whatever version of it, to be able to tell for sure. But it'd be interesting to find out exactly where they filmed or where the crowds were from, because I mean, they get good shots of the crowd being rambunctious and the crowd being enthusiastic, and I mean, it's a pretty well put together movie, other than maybe showing a little bit, being a little too repetitive in the footage they were showing.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. To circle back to one thing real quick. In the back, when Rosa is speaking to Luke and Tio, she speaks to them and she's like, "Hey, Luke, you're such a nice guy. I can't imagine you being the bad guy, unlike Tio over here," which is a little bit of foreshadowing that I think we're gonna get to as well later on.
Yeah, and I liked his line of, "I'm not a wrestler, darling. I'm an actor." And then,
Yeah, which is really good. Yeah.
yeah. So we go to Leroy sitting in front of a mirror, and then Rose is kind of just sitting there casually and talking to him, and he's kind of getting ready, and then suddenly he grabs a blade, kind of a long razor blade, and he just sort of cuts his head like three times, and he just starts maniacally laughing and screaming, and then she's obviously freaked out by it. And then we go to a where there's like a fight in the crowd, and then there's sort of like a quiet voiceover kind of indicating panic, or at least distress of like, okay, the security needs a gear, and you can almost barely hear it, but it's a kind of a nice like you kind of get the sense of like anarchy and kind of craziness of the crowd a little bit. It's actually kind of well done, in an odd way.
Yeah, well, like and later on in the movie, like I think after this whole segment, they're driving the next morning, and you overhear the radio speaking about there being I think like 13 people are in the hospital from serious injuries from the wrestling show the previous night, and the DJ or whoever on the radio is just kind of laughing about how rowdy and fun it was.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, they're in the car. On, this is kind of the beginning of them being in the car and on the road. There's drinking, there's jokes. It feels very much like, if you ever listen to old wrestlers tell about the stories of the drives that happened in the territories, or even more recently, this is kind of what it feels like, and then Rosa tries to join in, but then ends up telling a terrible joke that falls flat, which is an experience I know a lot about. So,
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, like the previous joke that the one established lady wrestler, the one established wrestler had said wasn't especially good anyhow. But yeah.
but Rose's was definitely worse. So,
Yeah. Oh yeah.
then they're in gym sort of training, and then Terrible Tommy shows up, the big women's wrestling star that we're introduced to in the beginning. And she and Rose have a bit of a stare down. And then Tommy tells about how in the old days they used to have an initiation, and it has the immortal line of, "Yeah, I'm pretty, but I'm dirty." And so Tommy challenges Rosa. Rosa decides to join in, even though she's told that she doesn't necessarily have to. But Tommy, no, she gets it. She understands what's going on. She'll do it. So, Tommy gets a Boston Crab right away, as you see kind of everyone milling around and seeing these two going at it. Then Rosa taps, sort of, at least one hand, in indicating giving up, even though tapping wasn't really a thing at this point. Rosa says she wants another shot, but then she gets tossed into the rope and pinned right away. So then they go down, and Fox sort of convinces Tommy to, or wants Tommy to help her out a little bit, since he has some plans for Rosa to kind of be maybe his next star attraction if it works out. Tommy calls Rosa a runt, but they insist that she's stronger than she looks. And then after a few more insults by Tommy, Rosa attacks her. Pushes her down, and then Tommy agrees that, you know what, fine, I'll have a match with you in Birmingham. Which is interesting, positioning Birmingham as some sort of like wrestling, as some sort of like major wrestling town where that's like, you know, where the big marquee match is going to happen.
Obviously, I mean, really can't wait for, WrestleMania 31 in Birmingham.
Absolutely. You know, I not to disparage Birmingham, because I'm sure it's a great town, but and that, you know, certainly was a you know, I'm sure it's a fine wrestling town, but it is sort of like, I don't even think Atlanta maybe or something else would be kind of the big town, but Birmingham, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely like this ominous like, nature of Birmingham being like this big like, important event that's gonna, place that's gonna happen.
Definitely, yeah. So we also had the other terrible Tommy line that I like is she's asked, "Who's your biggest fan?" And then she says, "My mother." I don't know.
Yeah, no, I really like that, yeah, because Bobby Fox is, is telling her, when she's initially refusing to have this match, who was there for you when you got out of the joint, who trained you, who's your biggest fan, and her response to that is just my mom, which is, I thought was really
Yeah,
funny.
the context was key, though. Thank you for bringing that up. I had forgotten about that when in my notes, but yeah. So we have another montage of wrestling action set to the gospel music, sort of showing a little bit of the wrestlers milling, excuse me, milling around backstage as well. We have Luke carrying Rosa on his shoulder, another example of kind of their attraction to each other. Also mixing in clips of the big matches that are taking place, including the San Martino and Executioner one again. So, again, repeating themselves a little bit on that. Then we get to another hotel, and we have this sort of who I don't really notice right away, but is established as a bit of a feminine hotel clerk, and he's familiar, clearly familiar with the wrestlers. The wrestlers are familiar with him, and one of the gruff ladies has line of well, I think it's important to say the actual word, so I'm going to say it, the "hey, you faggot," and then the clerk was like, "Well, hey yourself, sweet thing," kind of the idea, like, this isn't meant to be mean-spirited, this is meant to be them kind of playing off of each other. You know, it's sort of like a friendly, silly thing, that they're, you know, they know each other, that's kind of playing on the, but it's of course interesting that they're using that term, which it was a term used in movies much more in 1980 than is used today, and is, I don't think, had as quite as hateful of a connotation as it does today, but I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting, and the one and the woman who said it was like the most buxom of the bunch, who I believe was, kind of supposed to be the most attractive of the lady wrestlers in their little troupe right there, and a bit more flirty and sexual than the others.
Yeah, exactly. So that was just sort of, it doesn't really go anywhere, but it's just sort of an interesting moment that they have in the movie, and obviously dates the movie significantly. So then we the next scene that I like is they're in what appears to be a high school gymnasium, and then they show Rosa training while in the background they have cheerleading practice, and I, this kind of shows like the necessity of improvising during wrestling and the necessity or while being on the road in professional wrestling, and where not all, a little bit of it is big time, maybe Birmingham is big time, but you know they're also hitting these small towns and in these venues where there are not like huge amenities. You know, I like that it kind of shows that mix that you have in wrestling.
Oh yeah, definitely. And even today, like some of the best, wrestling shows I've ever been to were in, high school gyms, so.
Yeah, exactly. And even like, you know, big companies like WWE, they do small venues, and during when times when they, you know, when WWE was not as successful in the mid 90s, you know, they were venues kind of, they were doing small venues and may have had been in kind of a, somewhat of a similar situation. So it's not like the leagues are that removed from something like this. So I found that to be kind of a nice little communicating without saying too much, but you can tell that Rosa is, is pushing further. She's even sort of out Gene at this point, who's presented as sort of the veteran and one of the and one of the better ones along those lines. By the way, I initially thought that Gene was the same actress who is she's in Uncle Buck. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Well, Uncle Buck is great. Yeah,
the woman who's the principal who has the mole. Who talks down to Uncle Buck's niece.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was her, but then when I looked her up, it turns out that woman is like a famous acting teacher. So it was not her, but she looks a little bit like a younger version of her.
I will have to remember that next time I play, the old Kevin Bacon game there.
There you go, exactly. So, Anyway, then we go to and Rosa is playing is painting Gene's nails. So playing off of the earlier thing, the earlier line that we're talking about. And Fox talks about the girl that Rosa replaced, who apparently died of a ruptured stomach. And they're sort of saying because it happened. Because of Tommy, but Fox is like, no, Tommy is a reliable girl. You two are going to be friends. No fandangos. I have no idea what a fandango is, but I love that line.
No fandangos, and it's just kind of funny. I know you don't watch a whole lot of modern WWE, but there's a character named Fandango right now, so it made me laugh watching that the other day.
Hearing about Fandango, I need to check out Fandango because I've heard enough where I need to. There's a split apparently in the opinion of Fandango, and I feel like I need to weigh in. It's become too big that I need to weigh in it because I'm also important.
He's probably the most famous wrestler to ever come from my home state of Maine, so I have to support Johnny Curtis. So
there you go. That's right. Yeah. Well, you do have D'Lo Brown.
I do. That's true. Yeah, I was forgetting about D'Lo Brown. I should never forget about D'Lo Brown because D'Lo is the best, but yeah.
But he obviously went to Maine, University of Maine, so.
Yeah.
And they're talking about, and also I thought a line, I believe this is from Fox talking about the continuity of wrestling of this tour has got the old chance, maybe the new one coming along, kind of an important, kind of, the cycle of, bringing in fresh talent and out with the old, but still having some reverence for the old kind of thing, which I thought was kind of a interesting line and something that the sort of the film grapples with in some of the stories.
Yeah, like I think the line was something about, the fans remember the champion and they have to see the procession of, the championships, being kind of passed down amongst the, amongst the generations and how important that was to him.
Yeah, and that's sort of I think there's a lot of truth to that line in wrestling. I mean, there is some sort of, there's a value. Your championships are valuable or can be made more valuable if you kind of see that and you kind of see like, that a little bit. I that's kind of a good insight.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot about this movie, like a lot of little details, a lot of little lines of dialogue that really make this movie feel very real, obviously, whoever was involved in this film was, knew what they were talking about because like so much of it actually feels very real and it would just be very easy for it to be some caricature of what wrestling is. But they completely avoid that. And it's one of the first, it's one of the few films I've seen that really handled that,
Yeah, exactly. So we have a scene of Rosa and Luke it's after sex, clearly. Luke is getting dressed and slinking off.
Yeah, definitely. It's the old classic scene of, one partner trying to sneak away and the other pretending to be asleep, a bit of a cliche, but it works. Yeah.
But they don't spend a whole lot of time Chip and about him, you know, whispering sweet nothings or whatever, sort of, you know, it's just a little thing. So we have, then we kind of have like a crazy things that happen on road trips type thing where they're kind of, you know, they're playing pranks on each other at a gas station. One of the girls has a heavy hangover. And then it's two of the girls who are less sort of defined in the story. But one is sort of the buxom girl and one is the heavy girl. And the buxom girl ends up taking the heavy girl's gun and after a prank is played upon her. And then she ends up just sort of, you know, running away and shooting. Not at her or anything, just shooting sort of, you know, away into a grassy field or whatever. But obviously this angers the other girl and she wants to take it back. And then I love the line when they're back in the car and they're talking about the woman, the gun owner is talking about, you know, they want to take firearms away from the ordinary citizen, but that they really get things in the South. And that they understand that you shouldn't do that or something to that effect. I love that little nugget being introduced into this movie.
The more things change, you know, the more they stay the same.
Right. Yeah. It's a, you know, it's a Tea Party mantra in a 1980 movie. So, well, we're about to bring in Reagan. So I guess that's sort of the national mood.
Yeah. That's about right. Yeah. The Iranian hostages are going on at this point, you know.
You know, the modern conservative movement is sort of rising, you know, so forth. So anyway, we go to a scene in which Rose is there and some of the rest is there. Fox is there. And I think also Gene is there and they're discussing Rose's name. And Rose is Rubinsky. She's Polish. And they're like, well, Rosa Rubinsky doesn't really have much of a ring to it. And so they come with, they're like, Rosa, the Mexican Spitfire. And then they eventually come up with a Rosa Carlo, the Mexican Spitfire. And I like how every time that Fox says it, Rosa says, I don't like it. And then they say it like three times. And then she ends up being Rosa Carlo, the Mexican Spitfire.
Yeah, it's really weird because she's the least Mexican Spitfire lady I have ever seen.
I mean, I guess Spitfire, maybe she's
Spitfire. Yeah. The Polish Spitfire. I could buy that.
She's curly black hair. I mean, I guess, you know, there are definitely less, she could be blonde. She could be blonde and blue eyes, but yeah, she's not super Mexican for sure. You know, she doesn't have any kind of accent. And I guess if you just looked at her, maybe you could buy it. But other than that, not so much. So. Anyway, we have Rosa and Tio having a conversation. Tio making excuses for Luke not being around. Then she compliments Tio on what a talent he is and how he is able to, you know, keep everyone invested in the crowd and how he knows how to work the crowd and so on and so forth. We don't see any of this, but it's nice at least that taking a moment to show some appreciation for the art form of wrestling and what it takes to be good at it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think this is also the scene where Tio is trying to give her a large peacock pinata, and he claims it's from Luke because Luke was thinking about her.
I think that actually might be the next scene, but
okay.
Where they do that. But that does happen. That's certainly part of that development. But in this one, eventually she tells Tio to just call me Rosa. So they're kind of becoming more friendly. That's the important thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we have Rosa and Vernie are talking with each other. And Vernie's, you know, showing sort of her just being sick of everything that's going on, and, you know, sick of the road, sick of wrestling, you know, sick of, you know, what's going on. Eventually, Leroy comes into the door, knocks on the door. He wants to talk, clearly drunk. He sings to her. She opens the door, shows some disgust. They kind of get into a bit of a scuffle, and she pushes him away, and she locks the door. Then immediately after, he's in a bar and drinking, and then she comes from the back to him. They smile and hug, and then she keeps him from taking a drink. Sort of an interesting pacing there, I guess. Like, usually you would kind of have the first scene and the second scene would be much later, maybe. But I guess they're just kind of communicating the volatility of their relationship. Like, at one hand, they're mad at each other, but all is forgiven not that long later. What do you think?
Yeah, it definitely feels, I guess, organic in a way where, they're on the road together nonstop. They clearly care about one another, even though Bernie doesn't seem to fully wish to commit or to at least, acknowledge it to herself, maybe. And, they're both a little bit sad and, kind of broken by, the 20 years of being on the road or however long they've been. And, he clearly has a drinking problem and she's clearly not okay with it, but she's trying to figure out how to kind of, interact with that and still be caring,
So we another another road trip, drinking from the same bottle. I think maybe whiskey, but I'm not too up on my alcohol.
More music.
More music, yeah. We see Rosa reading with curls in her hair. And then we have a moment of Rosa sort of her climbing into the ring. It's empty. The room is empty. She climbs the ring. She's wearing a skirt and leggings, and she's sort of like she's stretching, feeling the ropes, kind of doing some hand gestures and kind of a little bit kind of playing to the crowd tentatively. And it's interesting because there's sort of like an echoing sound of the music. Like it's not there. There's definitely music playing, and I think it's meant to be the same sort of it's the same sort of musical they've been doing with the montages all along, but in this one the sound almost is like a haunting echo effect for a little bit. It's really kind of interesting, and then it kind of goes into the normal type of sound. I'm not sure if it that was intended or if that just sort of if that just was how it was mixed. But it kind of reminds me of the effect earlier when they had when they had the crazy crowd, and it was sort of like you had sound of of the security talking about the situation, it had that same effect, even though it was a different type of thing.
Yeah, well, like it definitely kind of makes the arena she's in kind of feel like, there's a life to it that's all its own. It really kind of lends to like this mythic quality of wrestling, I thought, because when I saw that scene, it really kind of, I don't know, it wasn't supernatural or anything, but it kind of made it feel a little bit more important and alive, maybe.
Yeah, you had like there was like a presence there. There was like a spirit in there. So not like a ghost spirit, but like a spirit of life kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So eventually we have a shot of Tommy coming down some steps with her entourage. Rosa comes up to her and's like, "Hey, you want to make a game plan?" And Tommy's like, "No, each of us just take care of our own." And that's sort of it. Then we go to a sign for wrestling in Tallahassee. Dusty Rhodes and the Stomper are on the marquee, although we don't see them in the film at all. Tommy comes to the back, and even though she's kind of cast as the villain in the film, everyone wishes her luck. She's sort of she's bigger than everyone, and she's not there necessarily like on the tour with them, but there's still the camaraderie of them being wrestlers. And then we were in a locker room scene of Vernie about as dispassionately as possible unlacing her boots. And her back is to a mirror which shows some scars on her back. And then John walks in. He's tired out. He begs to take out. He says, "We'll take care of each other." And she says, she's like, "You don't have to have a loyalty to Fox anymore. Whatever, he gave to you, you've repaid back so many times." And then she says, "I feel safe on the road." And then he storms out, and then she breaks down in tears. And it's, you know, it's definitely, you know, it's a heavy scene, but it's I think effective in what it does. I think it's the scenes with them where everything is sort of being. You know, there's not a lot of subtlety to these. I think these work because most of the rest of the film is fairly subtle.
Yeah, like, you know, and you know, while these scenes aren't especially subtle, like, you know, like the really, you know, gruesome scars on her back, you know, you kind of see them, you know, glinting in the mirror a little bit. You don't even like see them like, you know, full on or anything like that. And little things like that kind of make them feel even more important and you know, and hurtful than them being more prominent in the shot would have, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. So, so we have Tommy wrestling another woman who I don't recognize, while Rosa is in the crowd, kind of in a little bit of a business suit. The crowd here is heavily booing Tommy. They show like about a minute of the action, which I think is the first in-ring action that they show with the crowd involving the wrestlers who are part of, you know, who are part of the troupe.
Yeah, and you definitely get a little bit of that Rocky One effect where, you know, the first few rows definitely have people and the rest of the arena is very, very dark, so you can't really see a whole lot.
Yeah, so this is, I didn't really pay that close of attention to the atmosphere to get that detail, but that's a good good notice. And then they kind of make the idea that, you know, that Tommy's gone, has made it real and gone into business for herself, and the other wrestler is put on a stretcher. A male fan runs in and tries to confront Tommy. And, you know, the idea that, you know, she's kind of making a point to Rosa that, you know, this is going to happen to her.
Yeah, definitely. It's like one of these little moments and lots of little dialogue that kind of makes CM Birmingham seem really ominous. You know, like it's coming for, you know, it's coming for Rosa.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, obviously, we're talking about, I think this movie gets the details of wrestling as far as the lifestyle and as far as the camaraderie and as far as a lot of things pretty right. Now, obviously it's a stretch to believe that, you know, that they're going to set this match up, it's going to be real and so on and so forth. Cause we know that wrestling doesn't really work that way. But you know, given that the author, the book is about experiences that were in 1951, and it's not too long before the famous, you know, Mildred Burke shoot match that she lost, and you know, the consequence of that was basically her being the title taken away from her, and her you know, being maybe not blackballed from wrestling, but never really having, you know, the power that she had before, because the power was kind of with her ex-husband and so forth. You know, given that it's sort of taking place in, you know, in that time and that mindset, even though this obviously is taking place in, you know, 1970, whatever, you can kind of see where that's coming from a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, they make frequent, you know, mentions of wrestling being, you know, at work and everything, but, you know, at the same time, you know, a terrible Tommy, you know, has a very, you know, real threatening aspect to her that, you know, Rosa, you know, should be afraid.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not quite realistic for wrestling given what we know about it, but it's not like it's such a huge exaggeration that it like ruins the realism of the movie.
I agree. Yeah.
So then we go to, then John approaches Rosa and asks her to talk to Vernie. He says he stopped drinking. He wants to go home to his farm in Jersey where his mother lived. His mother's not going to be around for a long time. Rose agrees to do it. Then Tio stops by. This time he has the pinata, makes excuses. But Rose isn't buying it this time and has the line of, I always managed to pick the wrong guy, while inferring that she is getting sweet on Tio these days.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, and Tio, you know, so Luke and Rosa were clearly like the most attractive individuals, you know, in this little troop of wrestlers. And Tio was kind of, a portly schlubby kind of guy. So it's kind of nice to see her kind of, get sweet on him a little bit.
On looks and into a little bit deeper, sure. We show Fox away the paychecks, and Verdi at this point is mad at John asking for Rosa to talk to her. They reach Alabama, and at this point, one of the bigger girl gets the gun out and takes a few shots out in the air, I believe, while they're driving, if I remember that.
Yeah, it's she shoots like the Welcome to Alabama sign, I think.
Yes. Well, there you go. So I guess that's a reasonably appropriate reaction.
Yeah, it's a road trip.
Sure. Then Vernie, they all sort of talk about Vernie's future in a sort of brief scene where they're in a diner and talking about whether Vernie really wants to be part of this anymore. Then there's sort of more road trip singing and so forth. And Vernie is distracted by what's going on in the behind her. And then she ends up almost hitting a car and then swerving over into the side of the road. And it seems like everyone's okay and so forth. And then the biggest of the wrestlers, who I believe is Trish is her name, I didn't write down before, but she gets out, and then the car goes sort of slides down the embankment and flips over a couple times. Everyone is okay, though, some minor scrapes, but no one is a serious injured, but they now have to walk along the side of the road with their bags. They show them trying to walk around for a while, and then they all eventually just sort of give up and stop and smoke. But eventually, John comes around with his vehicle, and after a couple of turns around, ends up picking them up, and you get a nice moment with him and Vernie hugging.
Yeah, like this whole sequence, I thought, was a little perplexing to me, because the everything leading up to the car actually crashing was kind of, I don't want to say scary or anything, but it was kind of intense. And it kind of, goes off the road, and it's kind of, about to fall over, but it's stable in the moment. And then the larger lady, is like, gets out of the car, and like her weight is the thing that, unbalances the car from falling down. So it's like a very like Roadrunner coyote thing that's happening here, and everyone just is okay, like nothing bad happens, and they never really talk about it again. And it was just kind of one of those really odd things, I thought, and just kind of scary, kind of intense, but then, oh, here's a joke, and okay, here we're going.
Yeah, it was a little, yeah, that was kind of a weird, that was kind of a weird place to have a fat joke, I would say, and sort of a weird juxtaposition between that. I mean, they're banged up and stuff, and I guess it's sort of meant to be like one of those crazy, goofy, things that happen on the road. Maybe it's not meant to really be intense. Maybe it's just more meant to be like, this is adding color to the movie. It did feel kind of emotionally unsettling, but in the movie, it's not really meant to be.
Yeah, definitely. And the entire point of that whole scene was to kind of lead up to, John, rescuing, the women stranded on the side of the road. And I think the actresses were kind of playing up, the emotional distress of this more than it was kind of conveyed to the audience. And, Vernie was obviously really relieved to see John at this point, and he was kind of the catalyst for her maybe having a change of heart.
Yeah. So at this point, he drives to Birmingham. There's the song is about Birmingham, and it's raining. Eventually, and then once he drops them off, he's just like, I'm tired, I'm going home, I don't want to do this anymore. And at first she is reluctant, and then eventually she decides to go with them, and they drive off, and they have their happy ending. And at this point, all the women go in, and Rosa, though, sort of lingers and stares, and, maybe jarred, obviously, about the accident, and about, all the, the nervous about the match that she has coming up. But at this point, Tio comes in, and she freaks out to him, says that, you know, that she left everything she has in the world with one lousy suitcase, talking about, talking about Vernie and the fact that, you know, wrestling, you know, chews you up and spits you out kind of idea. And then, you know, Tio here is sort of like talks about the good points in wrestling, that, you know, he has respect, he entertains people, you know, he gets to sign autographs, his pictures taken. Like, it's not a bad life. It's maybe not for everyone, but, you know, it's kind of a it's a good thing. So I kind of found that I found that interesting.
Yeah, well, like at this point, I think we get the line that, Tio, admits that, Vernie put in 20 years and all she had to show for it was a suitcase, but, he has his respect and that's all that matters to him.
Right, exactly. So it's sort of like it's I guess it's kind of you're not trying to be overly negative about wrestling, or trying to at least present like, you know, okay, wrestling's good for some people, you know, or it doesn't have to be a damaging thing, but obviously, you know, it can be, and it attracts some of these, you know, oddballs and malcontents and so forth. So it was just kind of a night, and I didn't feel like it was like something like that can be kind of clumsy, but I kind of thought that it worked well, and it fit kind of with how they've been building the character.
Yeah, definitely. Like, and like the movie I thought about most while watching this was The Wrestler, where I kind of feel like, Rosa is like the beginning of the wrestler's, life, and everyone else is kind of at varying points. And, like the movie The Wrestler is kind of like what happens afterwards if you don't get out, in time, and I think it's a really interesting, these two movies together kind of provides like a really interesting, story of the possibilities that they could exist.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that for sure. We get to the point of where they're setting up the ring. The minis and the other wrestlers are coming in. Ticket sales, just, you know, everything telling you, hey, this is a big arena show. Gene tells Rosa, just listen to Tommy, go along with what the crowd tells you, you know, use your instincts kind of thing. We kind of have we see Tommy and Rosa sort of sitting there to each other backstage. Tommy is gargling and smoking, and suggests that we do a lot of keister bumps, which I found keister bumps, just because of, I think whenever I think of the word keister, I think of Vince McMahon saying the word keister, like in 1995 commentary, and found that amusing. And then we have a little bit of a little person speaking Spanish to Rosa and hitting on her. She seems to know Spanish at least a little bit, so and she seems to welcome the affection actually, which is interesting. And then Tommy immediately tosses him out, and because, you know, no antic.
Yeah, it's really nice flirting there. Like, he talks about wanting to take Rosa to Puerto Rico, which I thought was kind of sweet.
Exactly. So, and also, you know, good wrestling area. So, maybe Rosa could, you know, be the Mexican. Maybe she could be the Polish Spitfire there. Maybe she'd, maybe a Polish heel would get over well in Puerto Rico. I don't know.
Maybe, I'm not sure. Like I actually lived in Puerto Rico and I only remember really bad wrestling back then, so.
There you go. So we have a lot of hoopla for the entrances. Now Tommy's from Birmingham, so the crowd is behind her. Rose is nervous as she's getting in the ring. Openly, she tosses a little bit of garbage that's thrown out of the ring. Tommy, meanwhile, does sit-ups on the turnbuckle. Rosa tries to avoid her to start off with, and then we basically go through the match. They sort of Rosa does get to take her down a little bit, but Tommy gets on top, and then eventually knocks her out of the ring. Rosa gets bill speared on her, beer spilled on her, and then back in the ring, Tommy shoves her out again. And Rosa bleeds for a little bit. Tommy gets into it with the ref, and Rosa gets back in. And finally, it gets hip tosses, and I got they shoot this eye gouge, like they get like a close up of her face, and sort of like the effect that they have, like tearing into her eyes, like makes it look really vicious.
It was like, kind of shockingly vicious.
Yeah, which I thought was almost like a little bit like a horror type effect, just very briefly, but really interesting. Tommy is tossed out. Rosa then bites her and grabs her by the throat. And at this point, the crowd is getting behind Rosa, and Tommy's bleeding a bit in the nose and the mouth. Tommy finally chokes her and attacks, gets an airplane spin, and then she takes off the ref's shirt. Tommy then stomps on her a bunch, and they make everything look pretty stiff and pretty tight. And Rosa does well, in her limited scenes in wrestling, both in the montages and in this scene, of making the wrestling look good. I assume that Tommy was a wrestler. I didn't actually get a chance to look that up, but Rosa, was a was an actress mostly on Broadway, so I don't I assume that she underwent wrestling training for this role, and does a serviceable job as a as wrestler.
Like she's not, chain wrestling or being like Tsubasa Kuragaki good or anything, but it's definitely believable, especially for the time frame we're talking about.
We get she goes to the top, Tommy does, and we sort of get to where everyone is kind of yelling to Rosa to watch out for the splash and to open her eyes, and then we get this like close up of Rosa and kind of again sort of like a horror effect of her eyes just being like shocked, and then you see her roll, and Tommy leaped off for a splash, and she misses it. Match is over because she is, and she's unconscious. And the crowd is going insane for Rosa, who is still angry and is sort of being held back by the others. She sort of wants more, and then eventually we get really, really loud Rosa chants, and she sort of smiles at the end, and then. We the film ends with her walking out and being surrounded by fans, and then we get to the credits and more clips of kind of the wrestling and the traveling of the ladies. So.
Yeah, like it was really surprising for, the lead up for this, the whole match, to end with a terrible Tommy to knock herself out by missing a splash. Like it's the most anticlimactic ending I've seen in a wrestling match in a long time.
Maybe the psychology of that was a little bit better in 1970, whatever. But yeah, that because jumping off the top would be a pretty big high spot at that point. But yeah, it did seem sort of by 2013 eyes, it was definitely a little anticlimactic. So, but that is basically the end of the film. And again, it's pretty well told story. A lot of interesting things going on. The characters are very colorful and fun and engaging, and definitely a movie I recommend everyone check out.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And like it's one of those movies I think actually tells a really good, concise story because like the ending does seem a little abrupt because we feel like we're just kind of just now getting to Rosa's story, but I think like her and Tio's relationship is kind of like the perfection of what Vernie and like John LeRoy kind of had where they find happiness a lot easier with one another than Vernie and John do. So I think the ending feels a little abrupt when you start thinking about it. It kind of takes like the cyclical nature of wrestling and passing generations coming up and wrestlers retiring and everything. So I really really like the way the movie ends actually.
Jane O'Brien, we have a result here of her beating, of her becoming the first Hawaiian Pacific champion, later to be known as the All Pacific title. So she was a wrestler, and there is one Daily Motion clip of her a 3-minute match against Princess Warstar. So I may check that out. She also may have she wrestled Mildred Burke's gym apparently. according to a website called rockinroxanne.com. And there is some DVDs of Jane being involved in wrestling, boxing, and mixed wrestling matches. So there you go. And these may have been the type of, these may have been some of the sexualized type wrestling matches, if I'm seeing these, if I'm seeing these stills correctly.
Okay, that's really interesting to know, yeah.
So I'm interested in the 3 minutes. I'll try to link to it on the site description so people can check it out. But or on the podcast description so people can check it out, because I think that'd be interesting to see. So yeah. Anything else that you can think of to talk about as far as the movie goes?
Not really. I mean, just, overall, I think it was a really enjoyable movie. And I think if anyone is willing to listen to you and I speak about it for an hour, I really hope they get to go watch it, because it's a bit better than Ready to Rumble.
Better than,
It's a good movie, and I think it actually tells a good story. And there's a lot there's some faults that kind of date the movie, but I think on the whole, it actually has a really good heart and does some really interesting things that not a whole lot of like wrestling movies do, where it really takes the characters and these people as very serious individuals, while not making their lives seem very depressing. Like it could have very easily been a very tragic, sad, turgid movie, but it's not, and it kind of feels like there's a lot of life to it, and it feels very real and natural to me.
I would totally agree with that. It was really, it was well done. It's a movie that has some craft and has some, has a little bit of depth to it, and that's nice. And it's a movie that's really is attempting to tell a story and tell it in a good way. And it is a it's a you know it's a craft. It's a movie made by professionals and making something interesting. And there's, like I said, there's some faults that we talked about, but overall, it's definitely worth a look. So, all right, Casey, do you want to any thing you want to mention as far as plugs go?
If you guys want to, chat with me or whatever, I'm on the Twitter, at Hammer Dialectic. I've been writing for Daniel Matheson's rad new website, The Mandible Claw. I think it's the mandibleclaw.wordpress.com. I wrote a pretty good article, I think, about Alberto Del Rio and Ricardo's relationship, and comparing it to Don Quixote and World War I British lieutenants and their Batmen. Which I was actually pretty happy about. And but yeah, if you just want to chat with me about wrestling or whatever, it's always fun. That's how I met Jason and a bunch of other really great people. So yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I of course, you're I always enjoy having good wrestling conversation with you on Twitter, and it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Appreciate you chatting about this with me. And of course, if you want to talk about anything you heard on this podcast, or if you watch the movie and want to have some conversation about it, you can tweet Casey and tweet myself also at WrestleSpective. Friends of WrestleSpective Facebook page, check out at twitter.com/WrestleSpective, facebook.com/WrestleSpective. Also, we're on iTunes and Stitcher. I love to have some more short reviews and ratings on iTunes to boost the popularity of the shows. If you're into the show and you want to see other people get into it, that's a good way to do that as well. And so appreciate any feedback, any good conversation about the podcast or about wrestling in general. Always appreciate that. So thanks everyone again for listening, and we will talk to you again soon.